code number NA02-51. Copyright 2002, all rights reserved. Narcotics Anonymous World Services Incorporated presents Sowing the Seeds of Humility with Ike D., Maryland, and Sally G., California. Recorded live at the 29th World Convention of Narcotics Anonymous, held July 4th through 7th, 2002, in Atlanta, Georgia. Now let's begin this informative session.
Can't say a whole lot about him because I just met him. But I'm sure he has a message about our topic. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Ike D. from Maryland.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm an addict. My name's Ike. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Atlanta. I hope everybody's having a good time. Yeah. I'll be honest with you. I haven't been going to a whole lot of meetings, and I've been kind of hanging out with friends here in Atlanta and doing other stuff, but I knew at some point I had to get down to the business of why I'm really here, so. And it's just good to be here. I've been having a good time hanging out with my friends and doing stuff and being around recovery. So when I received a phone call a couple of weeks ago at my office about this topic, and I have Rhonda to thank for this because she had someone from the convention committee call me, and the lady asked me would I like to chair a meeting here at the convention, and she said the topic is sowing the seeds of humility. I'm like, what? You know, what am I going to talk about? And, you know, we've always been told here in Narcotics Anonymous that when you're asked to do something, you don't turn it down. So really, that wasn't the reason I didn't turn it down. It's really I didn't know how to turn it down. You know what I mean? I was like, yeah, I'll do it. You know, and then I thought to myself, what have I gotten myself into? What am I going to talk about? You know, my low self-esteem kicked in and said, you don't have anything to share. Nobody wants to hear what you have to say. You know, so I've been thinking about this meeting ever since she asked me to do it. But I'm glad that I accepted because the longer that I thought about it, the more I realized I do have a lot of things to share that are very humbling. But just to tell you a little bit about myself, I came into Narcotics Anonymous in 1984. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland. And, I think we're one of the pioneer areas of recovery in the United States, and we're real proud of that. But I came in 1984 after using drugs since high school. You know, it started off with marijuana and pills and that kind of thing. And it ended up with heroin and cocaine. Those were my drugs of choice. And I went into treatment in 1984, not because I wanted to, but I was trying to please my parents and my girlfriend, and I needed to clean my act up, or they thought that I should. So I went in there and stayed in there for a month, had lost my job, so I had no money to go into treatment. My parents wrote a check for $10,000 to get me in there. And so I went, but I didn't surrender. I went there, and I was very compliant, and I followed directions, and I said all the right things. And when I left there, I knew I was skating on real thin ice. And so what I did was I went around to meetings where they used to take the patients from the treatment center so I could show them that I was doing good, you know? And around my 90th day, when I was about to get that key tag, my income tax check came in the mail. Y'all know where I'm going with this, right? And for me, money is a trigger. Money, my mother always said, money burns a hole in your pocket. You can't hold on to money, you know? So I remember when that check came that Saturday morning, my mother cashed it for me. She said, you want me to hold this money? I said, nah, ma, I got it, you know? And I went on to the meeting Saturday noon on Liberty Road. And I remember at the end of the meeting, they said, does anybody feel like they want to use, you know? And I just refused to humble myself and raise my hand and say, I need some help, y'all, because I'm getting ready to go out of here, you know? And within an hour, I was in a shooting gallery with an NA t-shirt on, shooting dope and coke. Back out there again. And I stayed out for about 9 months. You know, I had met some people for the 3 months that I was here and cultivated some relationships. And it was very humbling to come back in these rooms after 9 months. At that time, our fellowship was relatively small. And if you know, certain people went to certain meetings and you missed a person if they weren't there on a particular night. So when I came back into the rooms, I couldn't get back into treatment again because my parents refused to pay for it again. And I had no money, of course. So I just had to do a cold turkey thing and just come back into the rooms. And I refused to humble myself that first night and pick up that one-day keychain, although everybody knew I was just coming back in. They hadn't seen me for ages, so, you know. But I wouldn't. I just sat in the back of the room, and it was a guy's one-year anniversary, and I just sat there with my head hung down, and I just refused to go up there and acknowledge that, you know, once again, I fucked up. Excuse my language. I need help. But, you know, people welcomed me back in the fellowship with open arms. And I got this time, you know, it was different because I was in there for myself. The first time I was around here just doing it for other people because I'm a big people pleaser. But anyway, this time I had a different attitude. I knew I wanted a different way of life. I was full of fear because I had no idea what living clean was all about because I had used drugs most of my life and associated with people who did the same thing. So I had really isolated myself from the larger world. And so when I came back into the rooms, you know, I had this different attitude and I wanted to stay clean. So I got a sponsor. I started going to meetings on a regular basis and I really didn't have an excuse not to at that point in my recovery because I didn't have a job. And as a matter of fact, I had a job, but I got laid off almost immediately. So I had all day long to go to meetings. We would go to meetings, you know, at noon. We'd hang out down Lexington Market, eat, and then go back in the evening and do another meeting. So that was my routine at that time. It was real humbling for me because when I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I had graduated from college. I don't know how I did it, but I did. And when I came back into the rooms, people said, you need to get a throwaway job. I said, no, I want a job where I can wear a suit and tie. That's what I'm used to doing, you know. I want to be in the office setting again, you know. And they said, no, no, that's not the way you do it. You're not ready for that. You need to humble yourself and get a job that you don't want to really hold on to just to get yourself started again. So I ended up working on a construction site. We were building concrete floor systems and office buildings, and I was like hauling steel bars, making $5.50 an hour. And that was my first job at Narcotics Anonymous, you know, with my Bachelor of Arts degree in political science, you know. That's what I did, you know. And it was a good experience for me because that was all that I could handle at that point. And I remember, like I told you earlier, how money burned a hole in my pocket. And it was suggested to me on payday, when you get your check, give it to your mother. And that's what I did. I had to acknowledge the fact that I couldn't handle money. And I would give my money, my check to my mother, and she would give me just enough back for cigarettes and to, like, eat and stuff with the other addicts in the fellowship. And that's all the money I had. The rest of it went in the bank because I couldn't handle it. So as time went on, I guess about 1 year into my recovery, I decided I wanted to go to law school. And that's something I always wanted to do because, you know, a lot of my dreams were destroyed by my addiction. And so, again, I was terrified because I'm always full of fear. I was afraid of rejection, and I'm like, what if they say no? And they said, well, you'll never know unless you try, you know. So I applied, and I ended up getting into two law schools. So then I had to make a choice about which one I wanted to go to. And so I decided on one of them. I went to the University of Maryland. And it was real humbling for me to go there. I was really scared because the voices in my head, I could hear my father saying, you never complete anything. You start a lot of stuff, but you never finish. You know, you talk a lot, but you never follow through on anything. So, you know, I had all these voices in my head, and I wasn't really feeling that confident about my ability to get this done because I knew that in school I never put my best foot forward. I was always a guy that slid by, did just enough to get by. You got to watch him. You got to supervise him at all times because he won't do what he's supposed to do on his own. You have to, you know, you have to prod Ike and get him to do what he's supposed to do. So with all that in mind, I went in there and took care of business. The downside of it was, prior to going into school, I was used to going to meetings every day, and I knew practically everyone in the fellowship in my area, but law school was very demanding in terms of my time and everything that's involved in it, so I wasn't going to as many meetings. As a matter of fact, it gotten to the point where I was secretary in a meeting up at the Greater Baltimore Medical Center, and that was the only meeting I was getting to, you know? The rest of my time was devoted to school. So after I got out of law school, coming back into the fellowship, I hardly knew anybody. Once again, I had to humble myself. I was going to meetings and looking around and not hardly knowing anybody. And I'm like, damn, I've been clean 5 or 6 years and nobody knows me, you know? And so I had to humble myself again and introduce myself to newcomers and get involved again and do all the things that I had done in the beginning. So as time went on, my career progressed. And I think what I did, I always kid my sponsor about this, but actually there's a ring of truth to it. I told him my outsides got better a lot faster than my insides. Because as we all know, and I need to say this for myself as well as the benefit of the audience, that social acceptability doesn't equal recovery. And just because you're a lawyer don't mean you're doing good on the inside and you got it together. Believe me, I'm a classic example of that. of someone who has worked hard on the outside but has fallen short in the inside. And it's humbling for me to get up here and say that, but it's true. I have worked hard, but I think I've worked harder on my career than I have on myself. But anyway, when I got back into the fellowship on a regular basis, you know, it just felt different for some reason. And I still didn't feel like it was in the beginning when I was on that pink cloud. And I started going to meetings again, and I started hanging out with people, but I was still really wrapped up in my work a lot. And so, just to kind of speed this up, I guess about after 10 years clean, I hurt my back. And I started taking Percocet. Didn't tell the doctor I was an addict. You know, always had this thought in the back of my mind that maybe one day I would use again, you know? And so I went to the doctor, and he prescribed the Percocet. And of course, in the beginning, I took them as prescribed, but that wasn't the way it ended up. And so after a while, I started taking two and three of them at a time, and I started drinking on top of them, you know. And the doctor said, well, I can't give them to you anymore. You know, this party's over. So what did I do? I went out and started snorting dope again. 11 years clean. I'm here messing with the dope again, you know. And wouldn't humble myself and tell my sponsor what was going on with me. And ended up, I promised myself I would never, ever again put a needle in my arm. But, you know, that fell by the wayside. My nose got all clogged up with the coke and the dope, and I went right back to the needle again. Back in the mix. And, you know, suffered some consequences, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. But anyway, you know, I ended up like, you know, I was like, at this time, I was, actually, I was a prosecutor. It was crazy. I'm working at, thank you. I was a DA for 7 years and helped put a lot of people in jail, you know. And but anyway, I relapsed. I was in the DA's office and ended up having to go into treatment again, just a little quick detox because I had needed back surgery because of my herniated disc. So I had to go in there and get clean for a minute. At least I tried anyway. But as soon as I had my surgery, the doctor prescribed the Percocet again. And of course, I didn't turn them down. I went right back on them again. And I was living with my parents because I couldn't drive or walk steps or anything for about 6 weeks. So my parents let me live with them. And, you know, I ended up shooting dope in their house. You know, while they were out doing their thing, I was inside doing my thing, you know. So just to speed it up again, you know, I ended up leaving the DA's office and I started my own business, you know, and still couldn't get clean. I was still in and out of the rooms. And, you know, here I am sitting in my brand new office and telling my secretary to hold my calls while I got dope and coke sitting on the desk and I'm snorting it. You know what I mean? Self-destructive, about to destroy everything I've worked for. And I finally got clean again, lost my girlfriend, one of the best women I've ever had in my life because I didn't get honest with her. She saw this crazy behavior in me and said, I'm out of here, you know. Wouldn't humble myself and tell her that, you know, I used again, you know, just it's real crazy. I told her after the fact, but it was too late then. But anyway, once I got into my business, I hired this young lady who, really nice looking blonde girl, you know, she was real smart, very talented, good rainmaker. Made a lot of money for me and stuff. And, you know, I was kind of vulnerable at that point because I was lonely. I lost my girlfriend and all that. So I start, like, liking her, you know. And this is real dangerous stuff because, as we all know, you should never get involved with people you work with, especially if you're an employer, you know. But, you know, I always think I'm different, you know. This was very humbling, believe me. And in the beginning, it was all fun and it was all good. It wasn't like we had sex or anything like that, but it was an emotional relationship of sorts. And, you know, it just got to the point where I wanted more out of it, and she didn't. She just wanted to be an employee and work and go home in the evenings, but I wanted more, you know. And, you know, she did not. And it got to the point where, like, I just couldn't stand the sight of her because I couldn't have what I wanted. So I made it real uncomfortable for her to be there. So one day she walked in my office and she did something that I thought would never happen. She says, "Ike, I'm leaving." And I'm like, "What?" And, you know, I did everything in my power to keep her there, but I was really powerless at that point because she had made up her mind she wanted to go because of my behavior. And it was very humbling for me to have to let her go, even though I had offered her raises and all sorts of incentives to stay there. She wouldn't do it. So it, you know, the problem was she was like running a part of my business that I hadn't really mastered. You know, my father always said, "You should know more about your business than any employee in your company," you know. But I'm like, "Yeah, right, whatever. She'll never leave me," you know. So I let her run it. I never had to deal with those clients, and she handled all the money, and all things were good. And then when she left, I had to end up doing all that work myself. I'm like, "What the hell is this?" You know. And I really missed her, you know, and I just really had to scramble and try to get my practice together. And it was just so humbling for me to try to, you know, do it all myself. And I just had to acknowledge the fact that I had made a huge mistake. And had I listened to other people, I would have just, you know, resisted that temptation. But I just refused to do it. I wouldn't leave well enough alone. But let me go back and tell you all about something about the consequences I suffered in my addiction while I was in my business. When I relapsed, when I was in private practice, I went out to cop dope one day in East Baltimore, in North Avenue at the schoolhouse, and everybody in Baltimore knows where that is. Anyway, I walk out of the building, I got a couple of caps of dope on me and some coke, and the, you know, knockers come up. And they said, "Come here." And something, I started walking to the car, and then something said, "No." I just turned around and I ran, you know. And two of them jumped out of the car and ran after me, and the other two stayed in the car and circled around the other way. And so, you know, they finally caught me. Of course, there's like this real 20 or 30 foot fence at the schoolyard. And I tried to climb the fence. I don't know who I thought I was, watching too many movies or something. But that cop came up there and grabbed me by my legs and pulled me down and yanked me right down on the ground, you know. And they slapped the handcuffs on me. I mean, they had me rolling all in the sidewalk and everything. And I just couldn't believe it. I said, "My career is ruined. I am finished, absolutely finished." And, you know, I just like hung my head down. I was like just laying there on the sidewalk on North Avenue. And the cop said, "You're not under arrest." I'm like, "Well, it damn sure feels like it, you know." "What is this, you know?" And he's like, "Why did you run?" I said, "Because I had this shit on me." He says, "Well, we don't care about that. We're a gun squad. We're looking for guns, you know." I said, "Well, I don't have a gun, you know." "Believe me, I don't have a gun, you know." And they picked my ass up off the ground and put me in a car. The guy said, "Where do you live?" You know, he said, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm self-employed." He said, "Don't give me that." He said, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm a lawyer." He said, "What the hell are you doing around here doing this for?" He said, "Go get some help." He said, "Look, where's your car?" He said, "I'm going to drive you to your car, and I'm going to let you out, and I don't want to see your ass in this neighborhood again." And that was just God working in my life because, I mean... It didn't have to happen that way because I could have surely gone to jail. And that would have been the end of my career. And let me tell you something else stupid that I did that's impacting me right now. When I was using in private practice, I was in court one day representing a guy on a violation of probation. His probation agent was a real difficult guy to get along with. And we went in court, had the hearing. He lied and kind of changed his testimony a little bit. And I didn't like that, you know. So the boy was found guilty. The judge continued his probation. But out in the hallway, I confront him. I was like, "Man, why did you lie? We discussed this case yesterday. You told me one thing. You get in there and say something else on the witness stand." And so this discussion got a little heated. And I like pointed at him and I poked him in his chest a couple times. And I said, "You lied like that." He's like, "What are you doing, man?" You know. So he went and called the police on me. I couldn't believe it. Of course, right away, I realized what I've done is wrong. I said, "Oh, shit, I am in trouble." And 2 weeks later, I get a summons in the mail telling me to appear in court on an assault charge. I'm like, "Oh, man, this is humbling." I mean, here it is. I represent criminal defendants. Now I am a criminal defendant. I'm standing there in front of a judge who's known me and seen me tons of times representing people. And she's like, looking at the statement of charges and looking at me and like, "What is going on?" You know? And it was just so crazy. I mean, I had to go to one of my buddies who's an attorney, and I had to ask him. I said, "Kenny, man, I need your help." He said, "What do you need?" I said, "I need you to represent me." You know? You know? "I need you, man." You know? And then the guy filed a grievance with the Attorney Grievance Commission, you know, alleging unprofessional conduct on my part, and they sent me a letter. You know, when you get that letter in the mail, it says personal and confidential, you know it's trouble, you know, and they don't want anybody else to see it. This is between you and the commission, you know. So I had to respond to that and everything. But by the grace of God, you know, the criminal case was dismissed and the grievance that was filed against me was dismissed. You know, once again, you know, I dodged that bullet, you know. But here's where it might hurt me. Right before I came down here, a couple of weeks actually before I came down here, I applied for a judgeship because in my county there are like two openings. So a lot of people had encouraged me to do it. We don't have that many black judges in my area. And so anyway, I applied. But I was like real scared to do it because on the application they say, have you ever been arrested or charged with anything? You know, I'm like, oh man, I got to put this down, you know. And they say, have you ever had a grievance filed against you? I'm like, damn, I got to put that down too, you know? Oh, man, you know, and it just goes to show how, you know, the consequences of my behavior come back to haunt me, you know? Now here I am probably trying to reach the pinnacle of my career, and my behavior and the things that I've done in the past might prevent me from doing it, you know? But, you know, I humbled myself, and I filed the application, and I'm just going to go ahead through with it because the decision and the outcome is in God's hands and it's not in my hands. Yeah, it really is. So I'm hoping for the best, you know, but it's a humbling process because it's a lot of manipulation and a lot of politics about this thing. And you got to kiss a lot of people's butts and suck up to them, you know, and all to try to get this thing. And my secretary called me yesterday and says, you got these interviews with the Gay and Lesbian Bar Association and the Black Bar Association and the Women's Bar Association, and you got to appear before all of them and tell them about how you're going to be such a good judge, you know. So, you know, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it because, you know, right now I'm independent and free because I'm my own businessman and I make my own hours and set my own rules. So, you know, but there's some benefits to sitting on the bench, too, because I think I'd be a good judge. But anyway. one thing they don't know, I don't think they know anything about my addiction. And, you know, I think it's important to have somebody up there that's got the experience with that because I've been on both sides of the table, you know. That's for sure. I've been a criminal and a lawyer. I have done it all. But I tell you, you know, one of the difficult things in my life today is my inability to sustain relationships. I have had such a difficult time with that, you know. And I've been to therapy and I've worked steps and I've talked to my sponsor and I've shared this with other people. But for some reason, that has eluded me, you know. I'm a difficult person to get to know, not because I'm standoffish and not friendly, but for some reason I find it difficult to open up to people, you know what I mean, and to share the real me for fear of, I guess, maybe you won't like me or maybe I'm not all you think that I am, you know, because a lot of what I've done in my life is about image. And I grew up in a family where we didn't share our feelings and you never let them see you sweat, you know. You maintain that stiffer upper lip and you maintained your image, you know. And it was hard for me to humble myself and come in these rooms and try to let my guard down and be honest. You know, the self-honesty that we talk about in these rooms is very humbling for me to do. You know, and I still haven't mastered it, you know, but I'm still trying. I'm trying like the devil. We went up to Pete Eater's restaurant last night in Buckhead, and it was a lot of gorgeous women coming in and out of there, young girls, the kind I like, you know. But I tell you one thing that's humbling. Because I'm 46, I'll be 47 years old, and them young girls, I'm looking at them, but they ain't looking at me. Them days are gone by for Ike Dixon. They really have, you know, and it's humbling for me to acknowledge that. I mean, I really have nothing in common with a 20-year-old woman except a physical attraction. That's the truth of the matter. But you know what I mean? It's like those days when I should have been with them women, I was shooting dope and ripping and running the streets. And it's humbling for me to acknowledge, and my sponsor always tells me to stay in your reality, right? And my reality is I'm a 46-year-old black man that should find an age-appropriate woman, you know what I mean? Not a 21-year-old. That ain't gonna do it. But it's hard. It ain't easy, you know, because I still be looking. I'm like, boy, you know, it's just the way I am, you know? The sexual addiction, that's part of my thing, too, you know what I mean?
But I have to humble myself and acknowledge the fact that, you know, I'm balding and I got a receding hairline and I wear glasses and all that. You know what I'm saying? I ain't as attractive to them young girls as I was a while ago. You know, that stage in my life has passed me. And my sponsor always talks about growing old but not growing up. He always talks about that. And I need to do that in a lot of areas of my life. I need to humble myself and acknowledge that I'm about to hit my middle ages. I'm not a teenager anymore. And I need to act my age, you know. But it ain't easy. It's not easy to do. Believe me, it's not easy. I'm fighting it with tooth and nail, believe me. But God has truly blessed me. As many times as I've screwed up and as many times as I've tried to destroy everything I've worked for, He has given me another opportunity, another chance at life. You know, I don't know how many chances I have, you know, but I have certainly, I think, just about run out of them, you know. And right now, I'm just struggling with my recovery, getting to meetings and talking to my sponsor and, you know, a lot of times feeling sorry for myself because I'm an only child. I'm a mama's boy, you know what I mean? I'm a guy that's used to all the attention and all the resources being devoted on me. So it was humbling for me to come in these rooms and not be the center of attention, you know what I mean? I'm not the center of the universe. Nothing revolves around Ike Dixon. You know what I mean? It's a million other people around here that got wants and needs also. And it was hard for me, as I said, being an only child, to accept that and try to, I guess, acknowledge that and try to just change my way of thinking and relating to other people. You know, because in a small family with only one child, you don't have to relate with other children. You don't have to share. You don't have to, you know, be considerate or kind to other people because everything is about you. You know what I mean? And in a lot of ways, that's how I've conducted my life with everything being about Ike, you know? And it's been very humbling to try to change my way of thinking. What's even more humbling for me, and I found this out about going through therapy, is that I have a lot of self-contempt. You know, I really, all the hatred that I had, I turned inward on myself, and I started to destroy myself in a lot of ways. And drugs was just one of them, you know. But I find that even though I don't use drugs anymore, I still have that hatred for myself because it's so deep-rooted. You know what I mean? For some reason, I don't like Ike. There's something about me I do not like. Because all of my life I wanted to be like everybody else because I never liked who I was. I was never good with women. I never had that silver tongue. I wasn't a good dancer. You know, I wasn't a good talker. I wasn't none of those things. I didn't think I had anything to offer. I couldn't think of any talent that I possessed. I couldn't draw. I couldn't write. You know, I couldn't do anything. You know? But it's just so hard to humble myself and try to turn around that negative feeling that I have about myself because it's destroying my life, you know? And until I do that, you know, I'm going to continue on this path of self-destruction. And it's very dangerous. I can tell you it manifests itself in a lot of ways, you know. And I've tried to find so many ways to, I guess, get outside of myself through gambling, sex, women, spending money, whatever the case might be. I mean, I just bought another car. Why does one man need two cars? You know, it doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? Just running up bills and stuff. And this is crazy, you know? And they always talk about recovery being an inside job. You know what I mean? It starts from the inside, you know? Nothing on the outside changes how we feel on the inside. And, you know, I just have a difficult time internalizing that and humbling myself and asking for that help. You know what I mean? I really do. I guess it's a part of the false pride that I still possess in my persona, you know? Not wanting to humble myself, not wanting to let people know what's really going on with me because I'm a lawyer and I'm supposed to be up here and all this bullshit. You know, it's all bullshit. It really is. I tell myself a lot of lies, you know, trying to live up to the image that I think I have in the eyes of other people. And that's very dangerous. Very dangerous, believe me. So, anyway, it's 2:00 and I have finished, and I hope someone has gotten something out of what I've had to say, because it's been humbling for me. Thank you. I hope someone's gotten something out of what I've had to say here. I really appreciate you all having me here at the convention, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay in Atlanta. Thanks. All right. Ooh. Let's give Ike another hand, y'all. Yeah. Now, if you're ever in Baltimore and your ass gets locked up, you know who to call, right? Call Ike. I'm going to call Ike. If I can get away with all that stuff he was getting away with up there, I'm going to call Ike. I'm going to, you know. They lock me up, I'm going to say, hey, man, I know Ike. He's just like this. All right. A friend came up to me before we got started, you know, with the meeting and everything, and he was saying, maybe I should make an announcement about the cell phones and that sort of thing. And I said, well, nobody told me to do that. But I'm going to mention it, you know, because it is disturbing to some people. So if you could, you know, let's cut them down, put them on vibrate or whatever. All them damn jingles and stuff going off during the meeting. That's not too good, I don't think, you know. Excuse my language and stuff. I'm still growing and all. But no pictures? Oh, is that right? Did somebody take a picture of me? See, the statute of limitation ain't up on me, boy. Telling you the truth. If you took the picture, just take it from right here down. Put my face on that bad boy. Shit. I'm just trying to make it. I hope everybody's having fun here in Georgia. Hey! The Peach State. Yes, sir. Okay, moving right along. I want to introduce our next speaker. You see, I wore the appropriate shirt. I'm from Georgia, but you see, I got on my San Francisco, California. I don't know what part of California she's from, but from... Thousand Oaks. Is that next to... Oh, it's next to... Okay. You can tell my country behind's never been there. I don't know where it is. I thought it was next door to San Francisco. You know, I don't know where that is either. Somebody brought me a shirt, though. But our next speaker is from California, from the Thousand Oaks. California. Come on, give a warm welcome to Sally G.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sally, and I'm an addict. And we're all here just to have a good time, and I'll be done in a little while. You all make it. I promise you all still be, I mean, you all still be alive when I'm done. I don't know that you all still be in the room, but. Oh, my God. I want to thank Ike. he said the line, my favorite, one of my favorite lines in recovery about, that one about looking good on the outside doesn't mean, a social acceptability is not equal recovery. On my second year clean, a friend of mine sat me down with a basic text and read that to me, because I was very excited. I'd graduated college, finished the internship, had gotten a really good job, you know, going to work with all these physicians and publish and shit. Will you fix it for me then? I can't hear me either, y'all. I'm nearly deaf, and this thing could be smacking away or doing whatever, and I'd have no idea, so. Whatever. Yeah, I'm like Ike in that I consider myself pretty fabulous professionally also, and no, I'm one of the brilliant ones. I know how to manage and control. I've actually had the opportunity to take my character defects and harness them into positive actions. So now I'm a manager. And I like, you know, go into situations and I go, oh, I know how this could be better. And I tell people how to make it better. And then they do what I say. And then I evaluate them on how well they followed my direction. And it's fucking good. It's all good, you know. So I'm getting worked up this corporate ladder for this company that I'm in. I keep My bosses keep asking me what I want to do next, and I keep telling them I'm fine where I am, and then they just keep promoting me, and I figure if I'm going to work, I might as well make money, so, you know, I take the job and go with it. And the other day, I had to do this 5-minute talk in front of a group like this, except for, you know, they weren't addicts, and so they were, you know, not as compassionate and loving towards me, right? And so I got up there with my little thing, and I had a microphone. I put it on my right. I was so worried about putting it near my breast, like somebody would look at it, so I put it down at my waist, right? And so then the whole time I talked, I kept banging the microphone, right? I have no idea. I can't hear it. I have no idea. People are looking at me. They're smiling. I'm saying this stuff. And then after I'm done, all these people start coming up to me and saying, God, you did a really great job, but you know, you just kept banging that microphone. I was like, and so why didn't you tell me? Oh, you know, I was like, well, fuck you then. And I want you to know that I humbly ask God to let that be okay. They did not have to ruin the entire thing that I did, because I was supposed to demonstrate enthusiasm about this program that I'm in, a women's leadership council that I'm in at my company that's committed to making opportunity and visibility to anybody outside the, quote, good old boy network, like, you know, women and the rest of us, other people. And I delivered that message. And it was really an amazing thing to just let it be okay that, whatever, I don't get paid for the way I wear a microphone. You know, and next time I do it, I'll do better. Now, I don't know about y'all, but that takes a tremendous amount of humility for me to be willing to just accept that what I did was okay. And to not have to move into the arrogance of, geez, I'm the worst person, I can't believe I did that, and just go through that whole thing where I'm absolutely useless, worthless, I can't do anything right, and then just, you know, wallow around in that for a while. And I didn't have to do that day, and I think that's about the first time I ever didn't have to do that when I committed such a big mistake. But, you know, we can always walk away from those situations and go, well, I'm clean today. I'm a success. I made it clean one more day, and I'm okay. Because my job on the planet isn't here to earn money for that company. My job on the planet is to be here with us and to stay clean and carry the message of recovery. Okay, well, good. Now that we're all happy, I have a couple of things I need to just get straight. Did anybody have the opportunity to hear my husband share yesterday? Chuck, he talked, he was really funny, and he talked about intimacy and recovery. Well, if you all were there, you'll better understand some of the things that follow. The rest of you all just know that I love my husband. He's my right heart, and we go through everything together. Look, don't get all excited or have any expectations of what you think I might be able to deliver. I know I talk up a good story, but like, this is what I share. That this is what I was worried about sharing. And but then after he talked yesterday, I don't care anymore. It's fine. I can share this too. I've just been coming out of this pretty dark depression, and it was very isolating, and I really felt bad about myself, and I really needed to be alone, and the more alone I spent, the more I needed to be alone, you know. And just as I was trying to come out of that, was trying to look at myself and see, is there anything on the planet that I'm good at? You know, am I good at it? Because, you know, my sponsor says, write a gratitude list, you're being very grandiose, you're being very arrogant, you're so hard on yourself. It's like, you know, just like God doesn't make junk, that kind of stuff that she tells me those things, I just want to like shoot her with a green paint gun. Hi, Mariasha. She'll hear the tape. So I was, you know, well, I have this and I have that, and I get this email from the WSO, and it's asking me if I want to do a workshop on sowing the seeds of humility. Yes, absolutely. God, what a tremendous honor. And I run out to tell everybody I know, they've asked me to do this, you know. Yes. Totally proud. Woo, they're recognizing me. I'm so humble. I have a lot to share. This is so great. And you know, it was nice to be recognized for those qualities. So then I went home and I told my husband I got asked to share at the World Convention. What he heard me say was, "Did you get asked to share at the World Convention?" And he said, "Yeah, how'd you know? I've been asked to lead a workshop on intimacy." I go, "Oh, that's nice." And I thought to myself, "Oh yeah, when they ask us to speak on a topic, it's not something we know about, it's something we need to work on." You'll know, yesterday in his intimacy workshop, he talked about me farting. And you know what? I don't do that. We did not do those things in the house that I grew up in, and we did not have any other bodily functions either. It's like... Yeah, one of my favorite stories about my mom is that she never did any of that stuff ever. But she had this bathroom in her bedroom. Like, you know, master this bathroom in her bedroom. And I never really knew what it was because my sister and I was off limits. Nobody in the house was allowed to go into that bathroom. So, of course, every time my mom left and nobody was home, we had raced in there to try to figure out what's in here, you know? What's so private? And there was nothing in there. And I never figured it out, you know? But I did grow up with the idea that we weren't allowed in there. And I stayed single until I was 36, and I, you know, met Chuck, my knight in shining armor, and he swept me off my feet and dragged me out of AA and brought me to NA. And... Not really, but I like to let him think that. No, but anyway, so I moved in with him. You know, we got married, and I moved in with him, and we're like, he had this master bedroom and a bathroom, and he had two kids, and they started coming in, and like going into the bathroom. If somebody was in the other bathroom, they would like walk right into my bedroom and go in the bathroom, and I would just say, "What are you doing? That's my bathroom." They're like, "Yeah." Like, yeah. Anyway, let's get past all that. It's sort of humbling when you go out into the world and realize that all these things that I hold to be so precious and true are like just bits of insanity. So that's one thing to get straight. And then, you know, like I said, from the second that we get asked to speak, and I think most people, he and I anyway, second we get asked to speak, that's all we think about, right? So what you're going to say, why'd they ask me, am I going to be okay, am I going to do anything stupid, whatever, you know. And I want to know how many of y'all have ever spoken at any big meeting, convention, small meeting, whatever, been a main speaker anywhere? Okay, so I want to know how many of you are like me, which is, you know, I worried a hell of a lot more about what I was going to wear and how I would look than what I was going to say. It's like, once I get the outfit worked out, I know the rest will follow. God is good. Oh, man. So it's kind of fun anyway. So on the topic, sowing the seeds of humility, I thought, what does that mean to me? You know, humility and... I really think I can just sum it up in one sentence, and then everything after that is just details. And what I can say for sure is that after 18 years and 11 months of recovery, I am still not God. I don't get it, you know? I've been here so long, I think I would have figured it all out by now. I know how to fix myself and fix others and, you know, the whole thing. But I'm not, and I can't. And I still don't know what's best for me necessarily. And I've been in the program long enough to be surrounded by people who care for me, and I trust them. And I just sort of go along with the show sometimes, whether I like it or not. So a couple of months ago, when my husband was grouping me, where he was having a conversation with me, he'd been mad at me for a long time. And I was following, why are you, well, just tell me, you know, what is it? And he just casually mentioned how, you know, I'd let go of all my sponsees, and I really wasn't going to meetings, and I wasn't answering the phone, and, you know, I was just like getting more and more isolated. And so, you know, I just started to explain to him in all my brilliance and logic why I wasn't going to meetings.
This concludes side one. Please turn the tape over for a continuation of the presentation.
Which is why I wasn't primarily going to meetings. And he just looked at me and said, you know, Sally, everyone who stops going to meetings has their reasons, too. And I was like, ooh. You know, the humbling, the humiliation, the humility that comes to know I'm eligible, too. That it doesn't matter how long I've been clean or how fabulous I am, if I don't work the program, stay in the program, live in the program, I'm going to be loaded too. I can just hardly stand that. I just hardly stand that. Well, you know, so I had to speak at a, I mean, I was privileged to speak at a world convention once a long time ago. I was asked to speak on steps 1, 2, and 3, and it was like at 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, so you know, I knew there would be like 5 people there, and there were. And, but I just freaked out, and I called my sponsor. I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And she just told me, you know, take a deep breath, you know, look at my shoes, come back into the moment. That's what we do in my sponsorship line when you're out of your mind. It's like, okay, what color are your shoes? Come back to the earth. Come back to the moment. Get your little cheap self out of the atmosphere and settle down. And she said to me, Sally, so today I decided that, you know, I'm one of these old-timer women in our area that has haven't found it necessary to do the workbook yet. But I'm starting to feel a lot of pressure because a lot of people around us are doing the workbook. But I am still a person who uses the basic text and works the steps out of the basic text, which is a lot easier in the basic text, by the way. And that's not an implied endorsement. This is our literature, and you can use all of it if you want. And when I decided that everybody was just getting too busy with all the other literature in the program and nobody was paying enough attention to the basic text, I just started myself a little basic text study. It's Wednesday mornings from 7 to 8. It's called the NA Way. And my friend Mark A. started the meeting with me. And and we have a good time. And there's actually women that come to our meeting. We have a real problem in our local fellowship that the women, that I don't know what the women are doing. You know, I know that there's some women's meetings that people are going to that are in each other's homes and stuff like that. But but in the in a NA meeting, there's not that many women around, so having some at the morning meeting is good because now I can hook them, start dragging them to the other ones, right? So anyway, so I wanted to talk about the seventh step, which says that we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. So I went, I didn't bring my basic text, so I went over to where Miss Wendy was working, the WSO on-site, and asked to look at a basic text. And she handed me this one. Have everybody seen it? This is the basic text in large print. This is for our elder members. And this is what she handed me. She said they were out of the other ones, but I got it. And so, you know, NA comes of age, right? Now we have literature for our senior members. And in the 7 a.m. meeting, there's a lot of people who are, you know, working, and that's why they're up at 7 in the morning. And the book goes around, and people are like this, you know, that thing? And each other glasses and stuff. So I'm 46. And the people around me sometimes are too. Anyway, I would just, this step, the seventh step, and then it talks later about, you know, we have to be honest with them in order to be ourselves. And I just think that's, you know, I'm going to cough up there. I just don't want to be me, okay? I spent a good deal of my life trying not to be me. You know, as fabulous as I am, trying to be somebody else, it is like not happening. I have spent so much of my life trying to be a wallflower, trying to be quiet, trying to be unassuming, trying not to be too smart, talk too much, you know, just trying not to be there at all. And it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. What happens is that my personality, and all its, you know, exuberance, comes out all the time. But I just feel bad about it. And that's been an extremely painful process in my recovery. And I have almost 19 years clean, and the times that I feel the best about being who I am and feel like I can really, it's okay to just be me, are the times when I'm at somebody's funeral and they're describing, you know, this person was just a real character, you know, this person was a bit, this person was a lot of fun, and I kind of think, well, they could talk about me that way. If I was just being myself, they could talk about me that way. And then I think, God tells you, like at a funeral, thinking about how you can change your life so that they'll talk nice about you when you're gone. You know, I'm not like thinking about that poor person. And I'm not thinking about living my life today. That's my life. Or the life of I want to beat them, but they have never been beaten. I don't want you to think I don't want to beat my kids. That's the way I was raised, and it makes perfect sense to me. But I don't, you know, because the programs taught me how not to do those things. And through being in the program, I actually do a lot more good things, because there's a lot more of me that's good, that's like high with God, than the part of me that's filled with disease. And that is the result of vigilance in this program. Because when I don't participate, the disease just takes over. And my disease just tells me I'm a bad person and that people will be better off without me. You know, and I went to my therapist to explain to her why I needed to kill myself, because I didn't want her to feel. I didn't I didn't want her to feel like she had failed. And she told me that all my reasons made perfect sense, and she could completely understand why I would make a decision like that. But I needed to really understand that my daughter would never get over it, ever. And I had to realize how sexist I really am, because I have two older boys. I have a younger son. He's 7, a 9-year-old, 21, and 19. And when I think about stuff, I always just assume that the boys will be fine. You know what? They'll just marry somebody. She'll take care of them. They'll be fine. And my daughter is the one I worry about, because she's the one that I'm so afraid is going to turn out like me. You know, and people around me keep saying, that would be okay, Sally. That would be nice. Your daughter would have a good life if she turned out like you, and she won't have all the pain and horror, you know. So that's what the therapist told me, and she said, that's fine. Just recognize that your daughter will never get over it. Everybody else will. And, you know, I have just been very committed to not doing that now, and before I came, I went and looked up the words, looked up some words in the dictionary, you know, because I consider myself to be, like, really smart, and God forbid I should, like, make a mistake up here, check my sources, have the basic text in front of me, you know, look in the dictionary, write things down, and because I was thinking about the process of sowing the seeds to humility, and how that can mean so many things to so many people, and I know that in the first 5 years of my recovery, sowing the seeds of humility to us was a process of humiliation, right? And I lived in the sponsorship line of discipline and humility, and that is what would keep you clean. Discipline, humility. You go to meetings, you work the steps, you get humbled, you know, be humbled or be humiliated, and you know, and I did that, and I was good, you know, and every night I begged, and every morning I begged God to keep me clean, and every night I thanked him, and I cried myself to sleep, and I got up and I tried harder the next day, you know, and, you know, we seek out who we are and what we need in the program, so I had a real need to be a bad person and to have, you know, be a bad person. I had to have other people reinforce that for me. So I had this sponsor who would, and you know, the head of our sponsorship line was a guy called Crazy Richard, and one would think that that would like click, you know. He's known for his violent behavior in meetings. Oh yeah, I want him to be my sponsor. And so I had this girl for a sponsor, and I would call her and say, God, you know, I'm such a worthless human being, and I've done this, and I've done that. And she'd say, you are, and you need to write about it, and you need to be of service, and you need to ask God to forgive you. And, man, that was a very hard way to live. It was very hard, and I stayed clean, and I was of service in the program, and I tried really hard to make up for what a bad person I was. And, you know, there was just no amount of service that was going to make up for what a bad person I was. There was no pardon for a person like me. And so what happened to me is, and, you know, I was just satisfied to live that way because I deserved that kind of treatment for the things I had done and the person I had been. And then what happened was I was working out, and I hurt my foot. This was in the days of high-impact aerobics, and I hurt my foot, and I was so sure that the reason I hurt my foot was because I was fat and clumsy, and obviously if I was a nice person, I would never hurt my foot, because that's how I thought. So I just kept working out on the damn thing for 6 months, and when my foot got so swollen, I just bought a bigger shoe, and then what happened was I fell downstairs because I really couldn't walk, and so my hip was all out of alignment, and my foot was totally messed up, and I thought, oh, you know, I should probably do something about this now. So I went to the doctor, and they x-rayed my foot, and there's this bone called the sesamoid bone. It's a small, round bone on the base of your big toe, that part where you, that round thing, you know, where you get the calluses. Anyway, it was broken into three bones, and it was driven all completely up into the muscle. But, and he just looked at me and said, "Poor Miss Epling, you don't seem to know how to take very good care of yourself, do you?" I'm like, take good care of myself? What's that? You know, it's like, if I'm not hard on myself, who will be? You know? If I don't punish myself, who will? So then I didn't say all that to him. I just sort of looked at him, and then he said, doesn't it hurt?
And it was like, the 6 months of denial was gone. I was like, oh my God, my foot hurts. It hurts so much. It's like, he's going, well, we have to get those bones out of the muscles in your foot. You know, you're like permanently damaged. There's a lot of problems here. We need you to do this. We need you to do it right away. So I don't know if it's a Tuesday or Wednesday or something. I know he wanted me to have surgery that Saturday morning. And so I called my sponsor. And she said, okay, that's good, that's fine, I understand. And, you know, we don't take any medication for anything around here. I'm like, anesthesia for major surgery? And I am not lying. She said to me, we don't need to do that. We can use acupuncture instead. And in all my insanity and in all my self-hate or whatever, the little voice inside said, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. So I went through my little book, and I knew I had to do something, right? I was going to have, now I didn't have a sponsor because she said she wouldn't sponsor me if I did the general anesthesia, and especially if I took pain meds. I said, well, whatever, you, goodbye. And so then I was, you know. I had about 5 years clean when all this was happening. So, you know, I don't want anybody to think that the insanity is, you know, only in the first year, you guys. If you're in your first few years, oh, you have lots to look forward to. There's all kinds of things that can happen, and it's all good. Well, so anyway, I knew I needed a sponsor. I knew I needed something. I was having surgery. I was terrified. And so I opened up my little book where, you know, you write down all those phone numbers for meetings and never call any of them. So there's this woman, and her name was Pat, and I knew she had 10 years, and she had just smiled at me in a meeting, and I'd asked for her phone number, and this was way later, probably a year later, and I called her, and I told her, you know, I needed some help, that I had to have surgery on Saturday, and was terrified and all this stuff, and she said, okay, you know, I'll meet you tomorrow for coffee. So that was a Thursday, and we met, and she asked me, why did I call her, and I said, well, you know, I saw you at a meeting, and you were, like, nice to me, and she just said, oh, you poor honey. You know, she just wanted to take me in her arms and love me. It was so, this is how I was. And she said, she asked me to tell her about God, and she let me know that I was going to have to fire that God. I'm like, oh no, that God will strike me down. I cannot fire that God. That God did not, I did not surrender that God easily. And she said, whatever. She said, you know, she said, my God, you're just going to have to borrow my God for the surgery. She said, my God is strong enough to take care of you too. And I did it. And I had surgery, and I came out of it, and we started working a different kind of program. And that was the beginning of a different program for me. And she asked me to find a different higher power. And that was so terrifying. Like I said, you know, it's going to get the lightning bolt in the back of my neck. And she gave me a yellow legal pad and a blue Bic pen, which is the only way I do any writing. You know, 19 years later, or 15 years later, I'm still doing that when I write. And she just had me write down on there, you know, what I would have my God be. And I wrote down that my God is stronger than my own insanity. My God loves me all day, every day, just because I'm me. And my God wants me to have a flat stomach. And a balanced checkbook. Because she told me I could ask for what I wanted. And she told me that I could develop a relationship with a loving higher power that would know those things and would work with me to make those dreams come true. Well, you know, I don't have a flat stomach or a balanced checkbook, but I'm happy. So I think, you know, that whole thing, I guess it's, so that was the change from going from the discipline and humility to another way of looking at the program and how to live a program that would keep me clean. And I changed sponsors because I changed programs at that time. And I went to some meetings in Narcotics Anonymous in my area and had the pleasure of meeting Miss Patty Blonde from New York in Narcotics Anonymous in California and other people. And what happened was I had like 5 years clean. And I was just this, you know, God woman in NA. This was in whatever it was, you know, 15 years ago. And everybody was just so happy to see me, a woman with time, you know. And I felt needed. And I felt like there was actually, maybe there was something I could contribute to help others. And it was really the first time I got connected to, I actually can be of some kind of positive value. And it wasn't coming from the place of, I have to do this service and God, please keep me clean. And, you know, I'm so sorry for whatever. And I got a sponsor named Pam, and what Pam taught me was how to move from a program based on discipline and humility into a program based in compassion and gratitude. It's a tremendous thing. It's a very different way of looking at it. It's a program based in humility rather than humiliation. You know, there's a big goddamn difference there. Because I looked at the word humble, says having or showing a consciousness of one's shortcomings. That's cool. Sounds like basic text use that definition. And the definition to humiliate was to hurt and mortify. You know, and I think when a lot of people in the program, we talk about humble, humility, humiliation. We talk about it like it's all the same thing. You know, be humble or get humbled. Be humble or get humiliated. You know. And I'm just here to say that it doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't. That compassion and gratitude works. And if you need it to be and want it to be discipline and humility, that works too. You know, the program doesn't tell us one way or the other how things have to be. You know, our founder, Jimmy Kenyon, said that 12 steps and 12 traditions custom fit to everyone, something like that, they fit everyone, and everyone can come into the program and custom fit the 12 steps and 12 traditions to build themselves a life. Those are spiritual principles from which to build a life, you know, and that's what's worked for me. And I'm so happy, much happier, to be in a place of compassion and gratitude, you know, because I have needed it. I've been hurting so much for so long, and I'm just now coming to a place where I can almost give it up, you know, and It's been really an act of humility to stay close with the people who care about me and not just move to the people who don't. You know, when my last years of using, I didn't go see anybody without taking something because the people I hung out with didn't like me, you know. But if I took something, they'd let me stay. And my first 5 years in the program, I just kept hoping I wouldn't do anything that would make them kick me out. You know, and I shared that with my sponsor, Pat. She says, oh, we don't get to kick anybody out around here. She says, we all play in the same sandbox, and we don't get to kick anybody out. She says, that's why we have to learn the rules. A fair play. Do you guys want to hear me talk about something controversial, or should I just stay over here in the spiritual mode? Hey, you know, we are just having fun here, and I'm going to say something that my husband said that I'd never heard him say before. If you're enjoying and appreciating what I'm saying, that's great, and if you don't like it, please don't come up to me afterwards. I'm just not that well, you know? I just want to share my experience. Okay, this is my story and this is my experience, and I'm neither endorsing nor opposing. And remember when I'm talking, if you're thinking that you think I'm saying something to you, remember, this is about me, okay? Not about you, about me, in all my humility. So, you know, I've been a depressed girl for as long as I can remember. You know, depressed and misunderstood. One of my key memories from my girlfriend when we were 16 was I was explaining the situation and how, you know, they just misunderstood. And she just looked at me and said, oh, you are the most misunderstood person I know. I was like, what? She's so mean to me. Everybody's so mean to me. Anyway, I've had a very long history of depression. And I come from a family that has a long history of depression, only in my family we call it moods. We call it the Blackman moods. And these moods, like my brother would go to bed for 2 weeks and just not go to work, and he worked in my dad's business. He just didn't get out of bed for 2 weeks. Nobody said or did anything. When he got up and came back to work, they asked him, did he feel better? Yeah? My mother stayed in her bedroom behind the door. I mean, everybody, it was just, you know, that's the family I had anyway. My dad started yelling. Somebody just turned up the TV, and, you know, we all just sort of act like it wasn't happening. Anyway, so I came into the program, and the first several years that I was in the program, my friend Patty Ray is not around, but she and I were together, and like I said before, I was in AA in the first few years of my recovery, and Patty Ray and I had a saying that we don't drink, we don't use, and we don't kill ourselves a day at a time. And when I moved into Narcotics Anonymous and stayed, it became I don't use and I don't kill myself a day at a time. And you know what? It used to be really, whenever I used to share that from the podium, it used to be funny. People, like, they really related to it. They thought that was so funny. We don't use and we don't kill ourselves. Yeah, ha ha. But it got people who had time, as I did, it was less and less funny to them because they didn't relate anymore, you know? And I just really, it hurts so much to not be able to be okay. And all that old thinking about if I was just a better person, I would be okay. If I just worked harder, if I was just thinner, if I would just cook better, if I would just be anything at all, maybe then I wouldn't be suicidal. I don't even ask for being happy. I just want to stop wanting to kill myself. And I have these kids and stuff. And so ultimately, when I had 15 years clean, I went on some antidepressant medication. And it helped. The internal rage and the need to wish that it was over subsided. And my disease progressed. And just to make a long story short, you know, I'm on more medication now. I've had increasing difficulty, you know, being happy. And I feel really bad about that. I feel really guilty. I wish I could. Like I said, I'm not God. Because if I was fucking God, I would not have this problem with depression, okay? I would not take antidepressants if I could be God and make it different. People talk about those of us that end up taking antidepressants as though it's something we choose to do. Fuck you guys, I don't want to be this way, okay? God. The other thing that happened when I started taking antidepressant medication is I just started withdrawing from the fellowship. And I didn't mean to. I tried to stay present. But, you know, I just started withdrawing, feeling not a part of and feeling less than. Because I had people saying all around me, you know, I'm just so upset with these new people, they come in, you know, if they would just work the steps, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't have to be on this medication. Or then the old-timers who would do it in a very different way. I've never had to take medication. I've worked the steps. Well, great. You know, and I've been on the steps for 4 years, okay? I'm coming up on 19 years clean. I am the other half of Mr. and Mrs. N.A. in our local fellowship. You know, my husband and I are married. We have an open house. We have N.A. parties. We live the program. And these people say this to me now, I just want to go up to them and just like rip my blouse because I'm in pain and say, do I look like a woman who hasn't worked the steps? When you think of me, do you think of somebody who doesn't live the program? It's like, just shut up. You know not what you speak. And I am letting God move me from the feeling of humiliation because of my mental illness into a place of humility where through self-honesty I can accept and just truly try to be who I am. Woo. We have to be careful. Our program is a program of tolerance, and it's an inclusive, not an exclusive program. And we have to be careful that we don't send people out the doors because we lack compassion. You know, and it doesn't matter what the issue is. Anyway, I've been stressed because I knew I was going to end up getting hit and doing this thing. my girlfriend Jill at home came out of the closet. Somebody asked her regarding depression. Somebody asked her. I know I'm getting troubled. Anyway, Jill was asked to speak at a workshop on illness and recovery. And, you know, like many of us in the program, she has hepatitis C, and she figured that's what they wanted her to talk about. But she told them she's going to have to talk about depression as her mental illness. And so at the workshop, she talked about chronic mental illness and what that was like. And her mental illness took the form of depression, and mine is the up and down kind, you know. Which, of course, nobody ever talks about, the manic phases, because we're having a good time. Why would we tell anybody anything's wrong? You never sleep. You're happy all the time. You always want to have sex. You know, yeah, you know. So I told Jill that I would not leave her out on that spiritual limb alone. Because as my husband taught me a long time ago, sometimes it's lonely out on the spiritual limb. And when you're living things that you believe are spiritually correct, spiritually based, and the people around you don't agree or don't like it, it can be lonely. You know, but I am not here alone. I hope that if there are other people in the rooms that have something different about them that's helped giving their disease an opportunity to separate them, I hope that you all find it in yourselves to be able to look past that in yourself, to continue to focus on the spiritual principles in the program, and realize that we are a member when we say we are. Thanks for letting me share.